second half of our series here called Awe. We have a supplemental book, I'm sure, that you would enjoy. It is quickly becoming one of the resources that we're plugging in as a kind of a fundamental aspect of our teaching and training here, a book called Awe. And you can buy one at our cost. You can pick one up on the welcome wall, buy one today, and then for the next several weeks, actually the month of July, catch up, and in some cases, I'm sure, finish up right on time with us. Okay, if you haven't picked one of these up yet, we certainly hope you can and will. It would be very helpful in kind of growing on your own. So open your Bibles if you would. We're going to go back to the Old Testament today, and we're going to look specifically at a prophecy that has come by way of the prophet Isaiah. And in Isaiah chapter 40, we're going to come across the way that God has revealed himself, and not only the way he's revealed himself, but how we are to look at the world. So Isaiah chapter 40, we're going to kind of touch on a handful of passages there that I think will be helpful for us to get a good perspective. Let's start with Isaiah 40, verses 25 to and 26. Isaiah 40, verses 25 and 26. So in case it might help, the book of Isaiah is God speaking to his people through a person, through the prophet Isaiah. God's words to Isaiah, and then Isaiah passes those words on to God's people. And God is trying to send a message to his people, his family who belongs to him, his children who belong to him. And here's a part of how that chapter goes. You should mark, if you study on your own during the week, and it would be helpful to review all of Isaiah 40 together. We'll hit chunks of it today, but let's look at that closely here. Verses 25 and 26. Here's what God says to Isaiah to tell his people, "To whom will you compare me? Who is my equal?" asks the Holy One. "Look up into the heavens. Who created all the stars? He brings them out like an army, one after another, calling each by its name. Because of his great power and incomparable strength, not a single one is missing." So the big idea that we're going to talk about today is this, that if the awe of God is not the center of your worldview, you will view nothing properly. You can't see the world properly unless the awe of God is the center of your worldview. And it would be helpful, if you're not quite sure what awe of God means today, if I define it for you, if this is your first week with us here since last month, then you'll get your first look at it. If you've been here with us, this will be a review for you. But every human being sees the world, and it's shaped by what they are in awe of. Either awe of God or awe of something that God has created will shape the way that you see the world. So the definition of the word awe is this. It's whenever or whatever your heart is thrilled with astonishment or delight over. So our hearts are made. God created our hearts. God created us to take in with our senses these stimulating, astonishing, fascinating, delightful things that God has created, pointing to the Creator. And those things astonish our hearts. They capture our adoration. We adore them. We delight in them. And so when that's happening in our heart, which is constantly, it's either one thing or other, God has loaded the world with the things he created in order to capture and secure, to captivate our heart's desire, our heart's delight, we should say. So it's never a question of if we're worshiping, if our heart is in awe. It's never a matter of when. There's not a start time and a finish time, but our hearts have been created to be adoring, astonished, or in delight all the time. It's the question of where is the source of our awe? What is it? Who is it? And what is it? My oldest daughter, Kaylee, is transitioning to the next phase of her life, possibly leaving the house and settling into some college life and starting her freshman year in the fall. And I have been, as you can imagine if you've gone through the process yourself, buried in FAFSA forms. The Internal Revenue Service is on the scene We have been selected for verification to verify that the verification forms that we verified are verifiable. And we're in the middle of making sure all the tax returns have been updated and so on. I don't know how this happens, but it doesn't take much for me to sink into a small worldview. It doesn't take much for me, for my big God worldview to be sabotaged and undermined in an everyday manner that affects my living on a daily basis. In other words, it is so easy to load our lives, these details of our lives, onto our shoulders and be more motivated and be driven and be kind of fueled by low-level anxiety over the smallness of our life rather than driven, captivated, and in awe of the magnitude of a God-sized worldview. If you have infants, toddlers, probably just children or grandchildren, or you have a stressful job, or you have a family that's loaded with conflict, you might ask yourself on any given day what most influences the way that I think about myself and what on a daily basis most influences the way that I think about my life. All of us probably have been thinking this summer of all of the duties that we have, all of the responsibilities that we have, all the opportunities and difficulties and relationships, decisions and concerns that are kind of like flooding into our minds like a dam that has broken or an avalanche, and these things just flood our minds and they crowd out oftentimes right at the moment that we open our eyes in the morning. Things are, and in some cases keep us from sleeping at night, all of these concerns that are flooding our minds. Sometimes I think our lives are lived like a scene in Indiana Jones. You may remember this. There's a scene, I think it's the Temple of Doom, where there's a mountain and there's a ball rolling down a track on a mountain. And Indiana Jones is about two steps ahead of the ball. And he's running for his life. And this ball is rolling down the mountain and it's right behind him, but you're sure it's going to catch him and run him over. And for a lot of us, our life is lived like that. We just feel like if we take one breath, if we slow down one step, we're just going to get run over by the demands that our life is weighing us down with. It's so easy to get distracted by it all. It's so easy to forget things that really matter. It's so easy to go through a day without God ever entering our thoughts. And I'm afraid that perhaps what we do is we separate our lives into real life that really monopolizes all of our thinking, and then we have a separate life that we put our spiritual life into. And perhaps the awesome God reality doesn't invade our consciousness as much as we need it to. It's also possible that perhaps what once produced awe in us no longer produces awe in us because of the demands of our daily routines that continue to monopolize most of our life and drive us in a low-level anxiety with all of the expectations and the calendar and the checkbook and on and on. Here's what I'm mostly afraid of. This is something that our author, Paul Tripp, discusses in detail. Here's what I'm mostly afraid of, and maybe you are afraid of this too. I believe it's possible that there's a whole lot of functional atheism that exists in the Christian church. Let me say it again, functional atheism. Not people who say there is no God, but people who live their daily lives as if there is no God. Functional atheism. Our atheism not theologically, not spiritually, but an atheism in the practical way in which we see the world and the way in which we live our lives. What if that's true? What if that's possible? I mean, how many of you ever thought we as believers, we worry too much? You ever thought that? How many of you ever thought we are too anxious? How many of you ever questioned the possibility that we're just too demanding? We have too many regrets. How many of you ever thought, what if we're running after too many God replacements? What if it's possible that we're facing the ups and downs in our lives as if there is no God? We say there is, we believe there is, we read about him, but the way that we live our lives and we're facing the ups of our lives, the mountaintops and the valleys of our lives, and we're facing it as if there's no real God. Or we're facing it as if the only real God in our world is ourselves. We're the ones responsible. We're the ones sovereign. We're the ones who have authority. We're the ones It's so easy to have a formal worldview that's shaped by our theology or the Word of God, but has very little impact on the way that we decide things, on the way that we do things, and on the way that we relate to one another and react to things. We tend to live, many of us tend to live like functional atheists. Paul Tripp says in his book, Awe, that I just referred to, he says, sadly, many people who call themselves Christians live functionally compartmentalized lives. And here's what he does. He proposes that we have two drawers. And one drawer is filled with real life. You know, real life, the things that we dig into most, the things that we're most comfortable with. It contains everyday life stuff like our job, our physical health, our food, our drink, our friends, our leisure, our money, marriages, parenting, possessions, our daily experiences. This is the drawer that dominates our thinking. This is the drawer that dominates how we feel about our lives. It's where most of our emotional energy is invested. It's where most of our physical energy is invested. It's where most of our dreams will be realized, or in this drawer, most of our dreams will be either realized or they'll be crushed. And it's in the real life drawer. The big joys that you feel come out of this drawer, the big sorrows that crush you come out of this drawer. This is where most of us would envision the good life for ourselves and the good life for our children comes out of the real life drawer. And often we have little functional consciousness of anything other than what's happening, the mundane things that are happening in the real life drawer. And yes, people who have two drawers, they believe in Jesus. People believe in his forgiveness and in the eternity to come. But these beliefs don't have any real radical impact on the way we live our lives. Or on the way we think about ourselves, the way we think about our life in general. Do you think it's possible that this real life drawer separated from a spiritual drawer probably explains hundreds of thousands of Christians, wouldn't you believe? Many of us. Then there's another drawer, and we have a second one, and this is a very deliberate drawer, and it's a spiritual drawer. All the God stuff goes in this drawer. It's the drawer for Sunday services. If you get involved in any kind of church family small groups, it's for that drawer, tithing and offerings. Having proper theology, keeping the rules, any kinds of missions that's on your mind or comes out of your expenses. And if you're real spiritual, maybe you've got family worship in that drawer. But primarily, that drawer is separated from the real life drawer. And in this drawer, your faith is an aspect of your life rather than something that shapes everything in your life. And if you pay attention to what's going on with yourself, you can see clear signs of the negative impact of separate drawers. You can see that those drawers don't actually come together. And if awe of God is not at the center of your worldview, you will view nothing properly. And what Isaiah 40 does, what God does to us through Isaiah is this. He says that the human race needs a vivid vision of God worldview. The human race needs to see more clearly the glory of God. And what the book of Isaiah does is give us a set of glory glasses. Now, you don't have to admit this, but some of you are aging. And a part of your aging is that you have found yourself in moments of time where you are being asked to see something. But instead of seeing something, you're disoriented and the whole world is fuzzy and foggy and you lose your bearings. But it's a real simple reason. It's simply because you don't have your glasses with you. And someone's holding up a little screen and they're saying, look, Dad, look, Mom, look, Grandma, look, Grandpa, look at these pictures. Look. And they're scrolling through the screen and you're going, oh, those are so cute. I don't see anything. I don't know whose kids those are. But if I had my glasses, I could. And how many of you have started to walk towards something that you knew was the proper direction, hoping that you're going to make it to the right door or the right sign? You've got to go to the bathroom, and you're trying to figure out, am I headed the right direction? You don't have your glasses on. On and on and on it goes. Here's my point. For a lot of us, our life slows down, gets confusing, muddy, difficult, complicated, simply because we don't have the glasses on to see clearly. And here's what Isaiah does. Isaiah gives us some glory glasses, and these glasses are something that you put on a regular basis. You take these glasses, and the book of Isaiah chapter 40 says, here, I want to give you a new set of glasses so that you can step back and you can see every detail of your life. You can see it in a completely different perspective. And the issue, really, that we're facing is, do we live our lives with these glory glasses on or not? Isaiah says, I'm going to speak clearly to you, and I'm going to fix all of your issues. I'm going to comfort you, my people, and here's how I'm going to comfort you. I'm going to give you some new lenses to put on your eyes so you can see the world completely different. And he gives us these glasses here in Isaiah 40, and it helps us to see clearly that these two drawers are not separate, that these two drawers have to be put together, and all of life has to be lived in one drawer. That our spiritual lives and our view of God affects every other detail and reality of our life that is so pressing in our lives. And this helps us have a one-drawer life. Now, only when you wear the glasses, these glory glasses of Isaiah 40, can you understand yourself. Only when you have your glasses on can you understand other people. Only when you're wearing your glasses can you understand the meaning and purpose, right and wrong, identity, morality, history, and the future properly. And by the way, a lot of the confusion in our culture comes from people, Christians and non-Christians, viewing the world without their glory glasses on. And you know who's at the center of that worldview? Mankind. Women, men. People, in some cases animals, the center of the worldview. And it distorts everything. And what happens when God's children so quickly forget God's presence and his glory? What happens? God will challenge us. He will challenge us. And any view that we have, and you should have this in your notes here, God challenges any view of the world that places a person, that places an animal, that places anything other than God and the grandeur of his glory. God will challenge that view. He is a God of infinite grandeur, and he must be in the middle of it. By the way, when he's not in the middle of it, he challenges his people here in the Old Testament. And no matter what you're facing, if you have these glasses on and God is in the center of your worldview, then you will find that he has provided for us comfort that we need. And listen to what Isaiah says. Isaiah says to his people in verses 12. We'll read verses 12 to 15. If you have your Bible, you can read it. It might have to be queued up behind me. Isaiah 40, 12 to 15. Listen to this. Who else held the oceans in his hand? I love this. God is asking, you got it, a rhetorical, semi-sarcastic question to his children. And he says to them, who else has held the oceans in his hand? Can you think of anyone? No, really, you can't. Well, maybe it's me. Did you hold the oceans in your hand? Maybe you didn't. It's probably not. It's probably me. Am I reading the sarcasm into it a little too much? Probably. Who has measured off the heavens with his fingers? Did you? Oh, no, it's me. What a shocker. Who else knows the weight of the earth or has weighed the mountains and the hills on a scale? Who is able to advise the Spirit of the Lord? Who knows enough to give him advice or to teach him? Has the Lord ever needed anyone's advice? Does he need instruction about what is good? Did someone teach him what is right or show him the path of injustice? No. For all the nations of the world are but a drop in the bucket. They are nothing more than dust on the scales. Imagine that. There's a scale and some dust has fallen on the scale. And God is telling his people that all the nations of the entire world are just dust specks on a scale. In other words, they have no weight. They don't register any weight. He picks up the whole earth as though it were a grain of sand. Verse 22. God sits above the circle of the earth. The people below him seem like grasshoppers to him. He spreads out the heavens like a curtain, and he makes his tent from them. So not only does God exist, not only is God active, not only is he in control, but he is also so glorious that it's almost impossible to come up with the words to describe what kind of glorious God he is. And I've thought many times when we're having conversations with people who seem to have a rather well-developed theology, and they're telling their life story, and somehow or they're telling a story about a crisis or a circumstance in their life, and you can tell that God has been omitted from it entirely. And I thought many times the fact that they assess their lives in such a God-absent way could explain, it might explain some of the distress. When we relate our stories of our daily life in a godless way, maybe it's a way of discovering why there's so much confusion or despair in our lives. And I also wonder if it's possible that we're not discomforted simply because our life has been uncomfortable, but because in the discomfort we have brought such a fundamentally unbiblical worldview to the uncomfortable things that we're facing. And here's what God does. God doesn't just let it slide, he confronts. And you have this blank as well. God confronts his children because their vision of his glory is too small. Their vision, their picture of God, they don't have their glasses on. God confronts it. And here's what he says. By the way, if I told you that the Israelites were in turmoil and were far from God, would you be surprised in this passage? And Isaiah is trying to speak into the troubles of Israel. Isaiah, by the words of the creator of the universe, is trying to speak into the lives of his children and say, here's what God wants you to do, because they were complaining and because they were wondering where's God, and they were having questions about God's goodness, and they were having questions, of course, about God's character. Why are these things happening to us? How is it that God is not sparing us and rescuing us and intervening? And listen to what, in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 27, here's what God says in return to their complaining. O Jacob, how can you say the Lord does not see your troubles? How can you say that? O Israel, how can you say God ignores your rights? And then I want you to see this, because God is going to console his people. He's going to comfort his people. But he's going to do it in a way that probably you and I are unfamiliar with. It's unique to the way that we function as humans when we're trying to console and comfort one another. Here's what God says. After asking them, how could you say that I don't understand your troubles? How could you say, how could you possibly have any questions about me and whether I am ignoring your rights or not? Here's what God does. You'll see it on the screen behind me. God consoles his people very specifically. Here's how he does it. He consoles his people by reminding them of his ability, not by reassuring them of theirs. That's how he comforts his people. That's how he consoles them. He says, well, here it is. Let's look at it together. Verse 28. Have you never heard? Have you never understood? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all the earth. He never grows weak or weary. No one can measure the depths of his understanding. He gives power to the weak and strength to the powerless. See how those are together? He says, how can you question whether or not I understand what you're facing? And then he says, how is it possible that you would say I'm ignoring your rights? And then he goes on to talk about how glorious he is. Then he goes on to remind them how sovereign and how much authority he has and how expansive and how strong he is. He never grows weak or weary. He addresses really probably the massive number of Christian people who remember God, but the God they remember is small. The God that they think of is distant. The God that they think of is just by the way, this God that millions of Christians picture and believe in fits in a little drawer called the spiritual life drawer. It's just little. It's actually a smaller drawer than the real life drawer. And God is describing himself here, that he's not disconnected, uncaring, and seemingly unwise like the God that they believe. And this is why the worldview of Isaiah 40 is so important. It confronts our practical atheism. That is, it confronts our conclusions that God is a small God. That he's a God in a book. He's a God on a screen. He is a God in a song. And this is the mistake that was made by the Israelites. You might remember, do you remember when the Israelites were being, some of you remember this because you're familiar with the Old Testament stories, and for others this might be a new story for you, but there's a part of the history of God's people in Israel where he has set them free from the bondage, the slavery in Egypt, and now they are fleeing Egypt, and at some point or other they get to the Red Sea, and they look at the Red Sea, which is blocking their way, and then they find out that the Egyptian army and Pharaoh is pursuing them from behind. And this is so much like the rest of us. We've got the Red Sea in front of us. We've got a pursuing enemy army behind us. And we start to shake our fists at God and say, what is the matter with you? How could you let me get in this circumstance? How could you let me down? Where are you? Why don't you understand the challenges that I'm facing? And now it's not just the challenge in front of me, but they're pursuing me from behind. I'm going to get sandwiched between all of the turmoil of my life. Where are you, God? And what happens when you have small drawer, small God living with a tiny little worldview where you're in the middle of it is that you forget to see that God intervenes all the time. He oversees the freedom that they were given, and he's also going to oversee the rescue. But it's so easy to forget that in the middle of our turmoil. And if you look around you and you just look at the circumstances, you know what it'll seem like? You probably thought this already yourself. It'll seem like the bad guys are winning. If you just look around at your circumstances, it'll look like God lacks the power to do anything about it. By the way, when you think about some of the ways in which people talk about God in the middle of their difficulties, after listening to them, you can probably struck that if I believed in the God that they're describing, I wouldn't run to him for help either. I also would be in a panic. And in a way, this should be on the screen behind me, in a way, people are suffering not just because of the size of the things they are facing, but also they're suffering because of the smallness of the God they're trusting. Imagine that. What if some of the complications in our life aren't because our life is complicated, but it's because our God is too small. The God that we believe in, the God that we describe, the God that we see is just too small. So it's possible that if you're like me, you're listening to this today and saying, there's got to be a lot of people with a small God worldview, but one of them isn't me. I mean, I really see God clearly. I have been studying, Pastor, this is a great message for these people sitting next to me who are obviously so small God-y. Look at them, look how small, their hearts are little, 10 sizes too small. But it is so easy to think that it's other people who believe in a small God, but I've got my glasses on, my glasses are always kind of shined up nice and clear, but listen to this. Here's a couple of signs that your view of God is too small. In other words, here are symptoms of two-drawer living. Number one, your fear of man. Your fear of man. One symptom of a small God worldview is your fear of man. Do you ever wonder why some of us ride on a roller coaster of people's responses to us? I mean, if someone responds to us well, we're thrilled and we're climbing the roller coaster. When someone responds to us bad, we're horrified as the roller coaster plunges to the bottom, and we're up and down. It's all based on how people we respect and care about and admire respond to us. Why are we willing to compromise our convictions to get someone to accept us, especially someone that we need? Why are we afraid to be honest about our struggles? Why are we afraid to tell the truth and be transparent about where we're at and what we're battling? Why do we live in fear of being known? It's possible, listen, it's possible that if this is true for you, it's possible that your entire life is being built on what people think of you. It is to the degree that you're getting your identity from the people around you and not from the awesome God of Isaiah 40, to that degree you'll be paralyzed by a fear of rejection. Why? Because I have an innate fear of man. Secondly, there's another sign, and it's your anxiety. Or your depression. Your anxiety or your depression. You know, there's this great scene that Jesus is, in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus is teaching his disciples and he's training anybody who will listen to him, really, and he says to his disciples, hey, you need things, right? You want things, right? You need things, you need clothing, you need food, you need shelter, and so on. And he said, why are you so worked up? Why are you so anxious about these things that you need? Why are you so riddled with fear? And then listen to what he says. And then Jesus says this. Jesus says, you all are worrying like the pagans who have no God. You're full of anxiety like people who don't trust in a Isaiah 40 God. You are all worked up with anxiety like someone who has no glory glasses on. Instead, you put your trust in a God who cares for the birds and the lilies of the field. And when you do, all of a sudden you discover that your anxiety gives way. Why are you so anxious? Why so unhappy? Why so uncertain? Why do you feel unwanted or unsuccessful or unhealthy? Are you unemployed? Are you unmarried? Are you uninspired? Here's what Jesus says. Why would you be loaded with anxiety, slip into, in some cases, cause you to slip into a depression if you have your glory glasses on and he's the God of the universe who can do anything and sees everything? And Jesus proposes that he reminds them that we have a Father who knows exactly what we need and is committed to delivering those things that we need. And what Jesus is saying is that the anxiety of a believer is directly connected to whether or not they're wearing their glory glasses. If you think about it, most of us can remember times in our lives where we've been confused, we hit a wall, we're at a crossroads, and God seems distant. Maybe one of those seasons for you is now. Sometimes it creeps in, and other times it falls in, it crashes in during tragedy. And we couldn't see much evidence of God exercising his power for our welfare. And here's what we need. We routinely need this. You have a blank for this. We will need our awe recharged again and again. Our awe leaks. Our awe leaks into other things constantly. We will need our awe recharged again and again. By the way, look at the end of Isaiah chapter 40. Some of you have heard this passage and you're thrilled with this passage. You probably have a poster on your wall somewhere with this particular passage, but you recognize this. Listen to this. But those who trust in the Lord, they will find something. What will they find? New strength. If you have a Bible and you have given yourself permission and the Holy Spirit has authorized this, circle it with a pen in your Bible. The word trust. Trust in the Lord. What do they find? They find new strength. Those people who have their glory glasses on and they see God for the magnitude, the glorious infinite grandeur in which he carries, his supreme and eternal brightness. When you see that clearly and you have a perspective of God that is accurate, a worldview where God is the center of your worldview, here's what happens. You begin to find new strength that comes out of trusting that God. New strength. And then Isaiah goes into a little bit more detail as God gives him these words. These people will find new strength. And what they will do is this. They will soar high on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. And some of you, when we're counseling one another, we could really recharge one another's awe. I don't know about you, but I find myself routinely with friends and family and church family listening in the position of someone who is able to give counsel. And I wonder if you are too. You probably are and sometimes don't even know it. And in our personal counseling, we can be recharged. And here's what you need to understand, that even though Isaiah 40 is primarily a worldview literature, it's also comfort literature. God is comforting his people who are suffering, who are being besieged. And the nature of that comfort is very specific. Now, my dad didn't say very much. He was a soft-spoken, meek, quiet, generally quiet individual. But even though that's true about my father, one of the things I knew was that when I was playing sports growing up as a kid, I knew that my dad was my biggest fan. He had somehow been able to convince me that there was no bigger fan on the planet than him. And one of the ways that he did that was he routinely lied to me. But, you know, fatherly, nurturing lies. You know what nurturing lies are? Let me give you an example. I was invited to try out when I was 12 years old for the Syracuse Little League All-Star team, and I didn't make the team. And my dad picked me up we went for a ride after I found out, you know, that when they cut us from the team in Syracuse All-Stars, you just didn't get a call. So you were just wondering the whole time which inferior players did get the call. That was the question. So my dad takes me for a ride, and my dad says stuff to me while we're out. My dad's consoling me, right? I'm kind of broken up about it, and I really had hoped to do better. I had hoped to make this team. And my dad says to me, you know, Dan, you know what I noticed about the tryout? What's that, Dad? I noticed you're the best player on the field. Lie. Then he said, I also noticed there over the couple of weeks that you were trying out there, because my dad would sit in his car and watch practices, God bless him. There's a special crown, a special jewel that you get in your crown when you watch kids' sports practices. My dad said, I also noticed that for the 2 weeks of hitting, you were the best hitter. Of all those boys, you were the best hitter. Lie. I also noticed that not only are you the best hitter, but you made some really smart plays out there. You established yourself as the smartest player on the field. And you know what that means, don't you? I said, what, Dad? It means your coaches are fools. Isn't that a terrible thing to say to a 12-year-old kid? See, those adults who are overseeing this whole thing, they're jerks. They don't have any idea what they're doing. See what I mean? But my dad was trying to build me back up. He's trying to tell me you can do it. He's reminding me that it's not me. It's not on me. It's not my issue. And my dad was encouraging me. When we're Christians, we say things to each other like, this too will pass. Or we say, you can do it. We can say, look at the gifts that you have. We say to one another, you've got this. We say to each other, you're the best. Don't get so down on yourself. You're smart and you're beautiful, and you're talented. Spiritual people say, hey, whoa. Pick yourself up. You can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. But let me warn you. If we comforted and consoled one another the way God did it, we won't remind one another of how able we are. The way that we comfort and console one another in a way that God does it is to remind one another how able He is. And we say, hey, trust in the Lord. And when you do, you're going to find new strength. You'll mount up with wings as eagles. You'll run. You'll just keep running, and you will have limitless energy. Why? Because you're able, because you're gifted, because you're beautiful, because you're strong, because you're a great baseball player. And you, by the way, I got cut from teams after that, and I thought to myself, my dad is just a big, phony liar. Like, no, I didn't think that really. But it didn't work out. I wasn't the smartest player. I wasn't the best player on the field. I wasn't the best hitter. And it's natural to want to say to one another, you can do it. You can do all things through Christ. By the way, that context, don't forget, we just covered this a few weeks ago. What Paul is teaching by saying you can do all things through Christ is you can endure any hardship through Christ if you treasure Christ. And I want to just mention to you that when you're counseling one another, the real joy and the real strength and the real power in counseling is reminding people that we serve a God who is glorious, and I want to help you get your glory glasses on, and we can trust Him, and He can do it. Can you do it? No. Can your spouse do it? No. Can your kids probably do better? Maybe a little bit, but ultimately, your joy and your fix and your strength and your running without growing weary and your walking and not fainting has nothing to do with your ability. Has everything to do with your trust in a God who is able. And Jesus said the same when He said, you're anxious about things that pagans are anxious about who have no God. And last, you are recharged in public worship. Recharged not just in personal counseling, but in public worship. Research just came out last week that 50% of all people who do not attend Sunday worship services, half of the people in our country who do not ever attend worship services, consider themselves born-again Christians. 50%. Half the people who believe, who consider themselves believers, do not get together with their faith family on a weekly basis or ever. And in our public worship, here's what we do. We gather together and we routinely say this. We rejoice together and we say, "Who is like you among the gods, O Lord?" We sing with our voices from our heart, "God, you are glorious in holiness." We say with our words, "You are awesome in splendor." And we position ourselves to expect that God will perform marvelous wonders. And when we do that together publicly, what we're doing is we're recharging our awe. We're reorienting our awe. We are reminding ourselves of where our awe belongs. And it helps to become an active part of a worship family where this is something that occurs over and over and over again, where each of us get together and corporately we are stunned by the perfection and the holiness and the righteousness of God's judgment all over again. We're encouraged by the awesome truth of his constant presence again, where we're reminded together to rest in his amazing sovereignty again. And obviously, once a month in our particular church family, we gather together and we rehearse and we remember and we review that ultimately God expressed his love by sending his son, and whose ultimately his love would be demonstrated to us, for us on a cross.